Shalom and welcome to Israel Policy Pod. I'm your host, Shani Reichman, the director of IPF Atid, our Young Professionals Network of Israel Policy Forum. I'm joined by Neri Zilber, a journalist based in Tel Aviv and policy advisor at Israel Policy Forum. Hey, Neri.
Hi, Shani. Good to be back with you. It's been a while.
Yeah, it's been almost a month since we last spoke, but since we've spoken on this podcast.
Right, I saw you in the meantime.
We're just past the 6-month mark since October 7th and the beginning of the war with Hamas. So we're going to cover where we're at with this war, of course, and do what you like to call an around the horn so we can cover all the regional issues too.
Yeah, and this podcast format started, I think, right after October 7th as an emergency wartime podcast. And this past week or these past few days in Israel and the Middle East, definitely an emergency and wartime of a different kind. So I'm sure we'll talk about that as well with regard to the Iranian strikes Saturday night.
Definitely falls into the trope about Israel always being in an emergency mode.
Yeah, I mean, it's emergency. I mean, you know, obviously there are emergencies and there are emergencies. It also goes into the trope that in the Middle East, there's one hard and fast rule. It can always get worse. So obviously the devastating attacks of October 7th were an order of magnitude greater than anything anyone had ever seen or even thought possible. But what happened this past weekend, obviously no damage or casualties due to the amazing capabilities of the Israeli air defenses, along with the U.S. and the U.K. and many other international partners arrayed across the Middle East. But in terms of Iran firing on Israel, also unprecedented and could lead to knock-on implications, which obviously I'm sure we'll get into.
All right, let's get into it. That's obviously what's on everyone's mind. It's my understanding is the first time ever that Iran has attacked Israel directly as opposed to through its proxies like Hezbollah. It was probably a top most stressful night of my life, probably for you too. First of all, how are Israelis experiencing this moment of fear and anticipation, especially because they were told in advance it's going to happen? I don't typically see Israelis very frazzled. They were very frazzled. So tell me more about the uniqueness of this moment, too, not just in the attack itself, but also the coordinated defense against it.
So you're right, on all counts, really. Unprecedented, that word gets bandied around a lot, really, especially over the past 6 months and even past year in Israel. President Biden called it an unprecedented attack, and it's correct. It's correct. Like you said, the first time ever Iran fired at Israel directly from Iranian soil. There had been a previous instance where Iranian forces based in Syria fired on the Golan Heights directly. That was back in 2018. But this is very, very different. Arguably a declaration of open war by Iran against Israel, as opposed to what's often called the shadow war that's been going on between Israel and Iran for many years. So everything now is very much out in the open. And that's very different than what we've seen in the past. Also the scale of the Iranian attack, right? So you had over 300 what we call projectiles, drones, attack drones, cruise missiles and ballistic missiles fired at Israel late Saturday and early Sunday. But that doesn't really tell the entire story. So as one U.S. defense official told me the other day, this was the biggest missile and drone attack all at once in the history of warfare, ever, if you think about it. Nothing of this magnitude has ever been fired at a country before. And that's...
Wow. I did not know that. That's really...
Yeah. And, you know, some of my colleagues at the Financial Times were comparing, you know, the Iranian attack to what Ukraine has been going through in recent years. Via Russia, obviously. I think their numbers that they came up with at the height of, you know, Russian missile and drone attacks against Ukraine, the worst day, it was 150 missiles and drones. So arguably double the size of anything Ukraine has dealt with, at least on any given day. And also to put things in perspective, so back in 2019, our listeners may recall, the Iranians attacked Saudi Aramco, the big Saudi oil and gas conglomerate, with cruise missiles and drones. Can you guess how many they fired at Saudi Aramco in what was a very successful attack for Iran? 25.
I have to guess.
25 cruise missiles and drones. Wow. And our listeners may recall, too, that back in January of 2020, the big Iranian general Qasem Soleimani was assassinated by the Americans, some say with some Israeli assistance, but definitely under President Donald Trump, in the airport in Damascus, in Baghdad, in Iraq. And the Iranians retaliated 4 days later, and they fired ballistic missiles at two U.S. bases in the Middle East. Can you guess how many ballistic missiles they fired in that retaliation? 16. 16. You hate this game, but...
I kind of like this. I mean, I didn't realize the proportions until you said that.
The proportions are... So in this attack alone, Iran fired 120 ballistic missiles at Israel. 120. They fired 30 cruise missiles, and they launched 170 attack suicide drones. So just to give people the scale of the attack, so when some people say, well, Iran knew or was counting on the fact that Israeli air defenses and other air defenses would shoot all this down, and they obviously telegraphed it ahead of time, given the long lead time, No. Nobody could have known that 99%, according to the IDF, of these projectiles would be successfully shot down, thankfully. But the Iranians were playing for keeps. Mm-hmm. They were playing for keeps, and these ballistic missiles are massive, massive. So even if just a handful had found their target, a handful got through, but they didn't cause major damage to the Nevatim air base down in southern Israel, and one Bedouin Israeli girl was hit by shrapnel, likely due to the interceptions. But, you know, even if just one or two of these major ballistic missiles had truly found their mark, you're talking about major damage. And we'd be in a very different situation already. Now, to get to the crux of your question, it was a very weird, say, last week or so in Israel, because obviously this all started earlier this month. As everyone knows, likely Israel hasn't taken official credit, but likely Israel hit the Iranian consulate, so-called. It was a building next to the Iranian embassy in Damascus, and a few very senior Iranian military commanders were killed. And that set off a chain of reaction. The Iranian leadership from the very top, the supreme leader, Khamenei, and so on and so forth, began issuing these threats of a direct retaliation against Israel. And then really late last week, via our good friends in the U.S. intelligence community, that was when things became real. So there was kind of this holding pattern. Okay, the Iranians are threatening, but will they really act? And then word came from the U.S. intelligence community that, yes, it's likely coming in the coming days, i.e. this past weekend. And then Saturday was a normal day, believe me, in Israel and in Tel Aviv. The sun was shining. People were at the beach. People were on the boulevards. But then towards afternoon, evening, you started hearing more kind of chatter about, okay, now it's really coming. And then eventually the IDF, the spokesman Daniel Hagari, got on television and said, you know, this is likely coming and we're changing the instructions for the home front. So essentially... telling, you know, canceling schools for the next day, canceling public gatherings, and then more kind of specific instructions came down for certain areas of the country. But really, everyone was just glued to their TVs that evening into the night. And then the Iranian attack started. And it was a bit weird because obviously it started with the drones being launched from Iran, and they take several hours to cross, well, most of the Middle East and arrive at Israel. So essentially, we already knew that the Iranian attack was underway, but there were no alerts. There was really kind of nothing to do but just watch television and monitor reports either from Iran or, you know, across the Middle East. But then shortly thereafter, I think right around midnight or after midnight, then you started getting proper alerts. You know, missiles were launched, and then ballistic missiles, which take about 12 minutes to get to Israel, apparently. And then you had the alerts, and then you had essentially all these videos coming out that I'm sure everyone's seen of, you know, it looked like Star Wars, right? A massive number of interceptors, you know, shooting through the sky. And it was a bit interesting because the alerts were essentially focused on, obviously, the Negev, Israel's south, the northern West Bank, the Dead Sea area, and then in the north, basically northeast Israel, the Galilee and the Golan Heights. But where I was in Tel Aviv, there were no sirens. There were no alerts. You couldn't...
The entire time?
Yeah, the entire time. And I believe me, I was looking. You couldn't even see the interceptors when you were looking east from my apartment. But yeah, you know, people in Jerusalem got sirens. Again, I don't believe Jerusalem was a target, but you had, you know, interceptors kind of streaking eastward, trying to intercept these things very, very high up in the atmosphere and as far east as they were able, kind of beyond Israeli territory, beyond Israeli airspace. Thank you to the Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan, which did a lot over the weekend to help, essentially allowing its airspace to be used either by Israeli jets or coalition jets and the interceptors to...
Did they...
Yeah.
They downed a few themselves, right?
That has not been confirmed. So officially, Israel is not commenting on what the Jordanians did or did not do. There have been reports to that effect, that the Jordanian Air Force downed a few of the drones coming through. I can't confirm that one way or the other. And obviously, there are good reasons politically for Jordan to keep a low profile on that issue, not to be seen as literally defending the state of Israel, given everything going on now in Gaza. But we do know for a fact that Jordan downed or closed its airspace. And we do know for a fact that... as the Israeli military has told us, Israeli jets and air defense systems intercepted a lot of these projectiles, well, not over or in Israeli territory. And since these things were coming from the east, that leaves essentially Jordan.
Can you talk about the potential role of Saudi? Because I'm hearing what seem like rumors. I can't find anything that reputable about the role of Saudi Arabia in this. But there are a lot of rumors. So what do you think their role was, if anything? Or is it all hearsay?
So believe me that this is one of the key stories, key issues coming out of this past weekend and the Iranian attack, which is what role, if any, the moderate Arab states and really the Gulf states, Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Bahrain, played in all this. And it's... pretty unclear, let's put it that way. We know at the very least that there were U.S. military assets, whether air bases, you know, air defense systems in the region that played a big role in giving advanced notice. So essentially kind of tracking the missiles and drones coming out of Iran. And by the way, not just Iran, but they also fired from Iraq and from Yemen. So giving advance warning, tracking these things. And then obviously there were British and American jets in the air intercepting these things over, well, over the Middle East, let's put it that way. So at the very least, it was kind of with the tacit approval and agreement of various countries. But any active role by the Arab states, still unclear. And again, there are obviously political reasons for it. But, you know, really unprecedented in terms of just this coalition coming and defending Israel. I'd argue that's all for the good. And this has been in the works for a while. We have to remember, too, that Israel, for many years, was part of the European command of the U.S. military because the Arab states and the Middle East did not want Israel to be part of Central Command, which is the U.S. military branch responsible for the Middle East. But since, I believe, 2021, and obviously after the Abraham Accords that Israel signed with various Arab states, that changed. And Israel came into CENTCOM. And so there's been essentially this defensive alliance, at the very least, between Israel, the U.S., and various Arab members of CENTCOM, to prepare for just this type of situation where you have an Iranian, essentially the air attack against U.S. allies in the region, and what that would look like, what needed to be done. I know that a couple of years ago, we got into an Israeli transport aircraft outside of Tel Aviv, and we were flown down to this Israeli Air Force base in the deep south, in the Arava. And there was this big multinational training exercise of various air forces down there. And you had Emiratis there, you had Jordanian representatives there, and a few other Arab and Middle Eastern countries. And they were preparing for this type of scenario. And it worked, I think, probably better than anybody had any good reason to hope for, especially, like we said, given the scale of the Iranian attack. But again, this is a defensive network of countries and air forces. It's a defensive alliance. But yeah, Israel has been, rightfully, I'd argue, proud that this thing exists. You know, a sea change from Israel's kind of role in the Middle East going back decades. And yeah, it was played a big role in what happened this weekend and what didn't happen this weekend, which, you know, obviously things could have turned out very, very differently. And now I'm sure the question on everyone's mind, including Israeli minds, is what's next?
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you a depressing question first, even though that one is as well. Let's say Iran seems to have the capabilities. If they wanted to, they could do this. They could do exactly what they did every day for a week, right? What would that look like? I know that may not be in the cards, and we'll discuss more, you know, the question of how Israel's going to respond and what that will mean. But if Iran were to go hard, right, to go full throttle, what would that look like? Do the defense capabilities exist to prevent enormous damage to Israel?
Their defense capabilities exist to minimize the damage to Israel. But even if you take Iran out of it, even the missile and rocket and drone threat from Hezbollah in the north in Lebanon is massive and has been massive for several years. And the idea, and it's a deliberate strategy by Iran and its various proxy militias across the region, is to, if it came to it, try to saturate Israeli air defenses. The canary in the coal mine of this approach has been the Palestinian factions in Gaza, so primarily Hamas and Islamic Jihad, who, you know, we saw it at the very start of their war on October 7th. They tried to overwhelm and saturate the Iron Dome system. And the Iron Dome actually held up fairly well, given just the thousands of rockets that were fired that first day or two. Really unprecedented numbers of rockets fired from Gaza at the start of all this. And Hezbollah by itself has, you know, massive capability to try to do that. You know, far and away bigger arsenal than Hamas in Gaza. And then you have, you know, Iran itself, but also various proxy militias in Iraq and the Houthis in Yemen. So again, on paper, this all exists. And, you know, the Israeli officials say this publicly and they emphasize this to us as journalists repeatedly. These systems are meant or can't be 100% hermetic protection, but they're meant to protect a lot, especially key kind of critical and strategic sites like air bases and population centers, infrastructure, and so on and so forth. So again, we shouldn't get our expectations too high, given the great success of this past weekend, you know, and it was a great success, but essentially kind of all-out escalation by Iran and its quote-unquote friends in the region would look very different. And that's, you know, that's a concern going forward. But yeah, this is a deliberate strategy by Iran over many years to build up these massive missile and rocket and drone arsenals, because conventionally, right, these states these groups don't have, you know, they don't have air forces, they don't have tanks. So they've tried to build up kind of a unconventional counterweight to what they view as, you know, Israeli and American, you know, traditional arms.
So now let's move to the response with what our chief policy officer, Michael Koplow, called enormous chutzpah. Iran said this was just our response to Israel killing IRGC commanders. And now that we've attacked them, we're prepared for this round to be over. Like, that's it. We did our part and now it's done. We have everyone who came to Israel's defense, including the U.S., indicating they would like this to be the end of this round, which makes sense. But Israeli leaders are very loudly announcing that there will be retaliation for this. What are the different calculations Israel's making right now to determine what's an appropriate response for deterrence purposes, which is how we would see this traditionally in the Middle East context, and Israeli internal politics, while avoiding a regional war? What's the most likely outcome in your view? And what are the possibilities out there?
Well, you'll be happy to know that I've been getting this question nonstop since essentially Saturday night.
By
both my editors and, my Israeli friends and pretty much everyone. What is Israel going to do? So this happened. Iran attacked really in an unprecedented way, even for them, we should add. This is very unlike Iran. Iran, for many years, has essentially eaten a lot of these kind of Israeli strikes and assassinations, even on Iranian soil, of very senior figures. This time, for various reasons, they chose a very extreme approach and took a very extreme action. Again, we don't need to really get into the Iranian calculations here. But this is just via actual Iran experts that I've spoken to. And so it happened, and they've chosen to take this path. But the question really on the table now is, will Israel respond? When Israel will respond, and how Israel will respond. And so if we break it down, it's very clear that Israel, and really when we talk about Israel, it's the war cabinet running what was previously the Gaza war and the war against Hezbollah in Lebanon, and now has to make decisions with regard to Iran. So it's Bibi Netanyahu, it's Defense Minister Yoav Gallant, it's Benny Gantz, Gadi Eisenkot, Ron Dermer, to a lesser extent, and Arya Deri to an even lesser extent. But really, it's five people who have to make a decision. It's a very difficult decision to make because, as you alluded to, Shani, there are many, many calculations that have to go into this. So to the best of my information, Israel will respond. It's taken a decision in principle to respond to what is viewed as Iranian aggression. And so Israel likely feels a need that in order to restore the balance of deterrence vis-a-vis Iran and to dissuade the Iranian regime from trying something like this again in future, Israel will have to send what one Israeli official described to me as a painful message to Iran. That, in their words again, this can't be a cosmetic response. So in principle, Israel has taken a decision to respond. And so then the question is, when will this happen and what will it look like? So in terms of when, I can say that in recent days, I was actually very concerned that it would be imminent because in Israeli thinking, there's value in doing this in close proximity to the Iranian attack to send kind of a stronger message and also to maintain the international legitimacy for the action that we've seen since the weekend. So I was actually very concerned it would happen, now. I mean, if it happened now, we probably wouldn't be talking right now, Shani, which would have been a shame. Now my thinking has evolved a bit in terms of timing because the home front commands for the public, the restrictions that were put in place just prior to the Iranian attack have been lifted. So essentially, it's weird if you walk down the street now. I mean, life is back to a semblance of, wartime normalcy. Like, people are out, kids aren't in school, but kindergartens and kind of holiday Passover camps are open. Large public gatherings are allowed again. So here in Tel Aviv last night, Omer Adam, he's a very popular Mizrahi pop singer, had a big concert in Hayarkon Park, open air park. He's supposed to have another concert Thursday night. There's a big nighttime marathon in Tel Aviv tonight. So it doesn't seem like the Israeli authorities are preparing the public for any kind of imminent retaliation. And that's coupled with the holiday coming up, Passover, Pesach, next Monday night. So I don't know. The timing issue is tricky, but the government may wait until after Passover, or at least after the Seder. That's my new thinking / hope in terms of the timing question. And there would be a sense of symmetry here, right? Iran waited almost 2 weeks to launch its attack. So there was a lot of kind of anxiety and concern for the better part of 2 weeks in Israel about any kind of Iranian retaliation. Israel may want to return the favor to both the Iranian regime and, the Iranian public. So maybe after Passover, but I don't think the response will come in 2 months. I don't believe that will be the case. So that's just in terms of timing. The when is just an open question. How is probably the most important question. So it's almost like this Goldilocks conundrum, the Goldilocks paradigm. So the response can't be too soft, but can't be too hard. It has to be just right. That if you want to send the right message to Iran, it has to, like we said, be significant. But you don't want it to be too significant to make the Iranians feel compelled to retaliate and escalate even further. And so it's a very, very delicate balancing act, a very tight rope for Israel to walk. I wrote an article for the Financial Times yesterday laying out the various potential options available to Israel. And it ranges from everything from choosing to hit Iranian military assets and proxies across the region, but sparing the Iranian mainland itself directly. That's one option. I don't think Israel will choose that because it has to be kind of one for one and like for like. So if Iran fired for the first time ever at Israeli territory, Israel likely would feel the need to hit Iranian territory directly as well. But then you have an option, if you're going to hit Iran directly, will that be something more covert, right? Targeted assassination, cyber attack, something with a bit less fire and brimstone. Again, that may be part of a strike package, but I don't think Israel will necessarily leave it at that. Which brings us to the third retaliation option, which is a direct attack on Iran. I imagine that's Israel's preferred course of action, but I think it will be calibrated. It will be measured. I think, if Iran really tried to hit, say, air bases in the south and other maybe military installations, Israel will respond in kind. So I don't think Israel will start sending missiles into downtown Tehran. But the real fear, and this is the bottom line, is that what Israel may view as a calibrated and measured and proportionate response, even against the Iranian mainland, may not be viewed as such in Tehran. And so the question is now, will Israel respond? How will it respond? But then how will Iran respond to the Israeli response? And so on and so forth. And that's the real risk of escalation, of things kind of spiraling out of control, despite the fact that, again, I don't think even the Iranians or even Hezbollah in Lebanon want this to necessarily get completely out of control and lead to a regional war, which is obviously a major concern of the Biden administration and Israel's close allies, who are urging restraint, who are urging Israel as one person put it, not go over the top in any kind of response.
Okay, we'll be right back after this brief message. In the wake of Iran's unprecedented direct attack on Israel, Israel Policy Forum experts have been providing timely, clear-headed, and sober analysis on regional dynamics and the state of the Israeli-Palestinian arena. In this week's Koplow column, Chief Policy Officer Michael Koplow unpacks misconceptions surrounding Iran's attack and the opportunity Israel now has to undo some of the mistakes it made after October 7th. Writing in Foreign Affairs, our Diana Guilford Glaser Foundation Senior Director of Policy Research, Dr. Shira Efron, offers tangible recommendations for addressing Gaza's humanitarian crisis while underscoring the importance of involving the Palestinian Authority. Following Iran's attack, we've updated our concise explainer on the role of Iran and its proxies in driving conflict across various theaters. Over the past few days, Tel Aviv-based journalist and Israel Policy Pod host Neri Zilber has written a handful of timely dispatches in the Financial Times on the fallout from Iran's attack. Links to all of these resources can be found in the show notes of this podcast. If you rely on Israel Policy Forum for credible and thoughtful analysis, please make a gift today so that our work can continue to have an impact. Donate now at ipf.li/supportthepod or at the Support the Show link in the show notes.
Speaking of spinning out of control, Hezbollah is obviously a major threat to Israel, as we've mentioned several times here. Maybe even, well, it is the threat of Iran, but it in some ways is greater than the threat of Iran because it's on the border. Six Israeli soldiers severely wounded this week from an explosion in the north. And today, maybe it was yesterday in Israel, I saw that two Hezbollah commanders were killed by Israel. So where are we headed there? How does that factor into this? Is this considered a part of the attack, like communication via strikes with Iran? Or is this sort of parallel and connected, but separate?
So those are very well taken questions. And by the way, we should tell our listeners we're recording this Wednesday afternoon, and it's been actually a very difficult day in northern Israel. According to the latest reports that we're getting, 18 Israelis injured due to Hezbollah rocket and drone fire. In the north. That's a lot. That's a lot even for the past 6 months. So talking about, you know, response to the response, how will Israel respond to a very difficult day in the north remains to be seen. Our listeners will be smarter than we are, Shani, because this will likely come out tomorrow. But the interesting thing about the Iranian attack over the weekend is that Hezbollah did fire on northern Israel, I think primarily the Golan Heights, but it was more to check a box than to actually weigh in a real way. That Iran obviously fired from its own territory, and the proxies in Iraq and Yemen also fired in a real way. But Hezbollah, you know, has been doing what it has been doing for the past 6 months since October 7th. And so, again, that was a sign, at least from the Israeli point of view, that Hezbollah is also trying to keep things, you know, if not on a low boil, because things are not on a low boil with Hezbollah, but at least kind of on the same course of action that we've seen, this limited war across the Israel-Lebanon border within defined parameters. At least from Hezbollah's point of view, which is this kind of 20-kilometer band of northern Israel. And we haven't seen them really stray from that in a real way. And so the question is, well, especially after today, will that remain the case? And if Israel chooses to strike Iran directly, will Hezbollah then be either compelled or feel compelled to respond against Israel in a greater way than what we've seen over the past 6 months? So it's a major concern. And you're right, in a weird way, the threat from Hezbollah is greater than the threat from Iran, because Hezbollah is closer. Hezbollah is closer, and the flight time of their rockets and missiles and drones are much shorter. And so if you have at least some physical and geographic distance between yourself and Iran in terms of, you know, the projectiles being fired, you don't really have that luxury vis-a-vis Lebanon. And also Hezbollah, you know, they dominate Lebanon, right? They de facto, they control Lebanon, but they are not officially the Lebanese government. Iran is still a sovereign state with a clear government, and so it's easier to kind of strike at them or strike their assets and things that may cause them harm. It's a bit easier than to do that with a quote-unquote non-state actor like Hezbollah.
Yeah, that makes sense. Let's move to our usual focus, actually, which is the war against Hamas in Gaza. Last time we spoke, there was this will-they-won't-they question with the IDF planning a large-scale operation in the southern city of Rafah. With the Biden administration saying, please don't go in until you have a plan, a real, legitimate strategic plan, which we have not yet seen. So given all we've discussed with Iran, does that impact the likelihood of this going forward? And I say that as the news reports warplanes hit Rafah with airstrikes, which I don't think indicates a full-scale operation that we're talking about. But, on the one hand, we hear of being in this relatively low-intensity phase of fighting, the war winding down, and a desire for it to wind down. And I'll also add the news reporting that Israeli tanks are pushing back into northern Gaza. That's coming as there are other reports that the places where the IDF retracts from then see Hamas members come back up, which, goes against this idea that we are dismantling Hamas. So two questions, really. What's the future with Rafah? And is this war actually winding down? And what does that look like?
So I'll start my answer by tying it back to Iran. And we should note that there is a kind of alternative debate going on, not only amongst, the Israeli public, but also amongst very senior former Israeli officials, whether political or military, counseling this government and counseling this war cabinet to not respond against Iran, that Israel should keep its powder dry, that it should maintain the international legitimacy, the international coalition that we saw activated in a real way over the weekend, and most importantly, to keep Israel's eye on the ball to the ongoing war in Gaza, and also, by the way, in Lebanon, but mostly in Gaza, that there's still a lot of work to be done vis-a-vis Hamas in the Gaza Strip. There's obviously 133 Israeli hostages still being held by Hamas in Gaza, and that the one thing you don't need now is to open up a new front against Iran to sway both attention and resources, especially military, from the primary effort, which is the war goals in Gaza. And so we should note, not only for the record, but also in a real way, that there is a counter-argument to what the war cabinet, I think, has decided to do. Again, we don't know what they're going to do until they actually do it, but there are a lot of people here arguing that Iran can wait even after the real provocation of the weekend, and that the war in Gaza should be concluded. And you're right. In recent weeks, there are increasing voices in Israel essentially saying that the war in Gaza is over, that the real war in Gaza that we saw in the first, say, 4 months or so, 4 or 5 months, has wound down. There's only, to the best of my understanding, 2 IDF brigades inside the Gaza Strip operating right now, maybe less than 2, depending on the day. And that this really is the middle, or we're in the midst of, the low intensity phase of the conflict as mapped out from the very beginning by Israel's war planners, that you had this very high intensity phase going after Hamas's brigades and military infrastructure, weapons, rockets, tunnels, and the like. Did a lot of damage, kind of deteriorating those capabilities. But now, obviously, the vast majority of IDF forces have been withdrawn from the Gaza Strip, and that we're now seeing raids into specific areas, specific neighborhoods of Gaza to go after remnants of Hamas, certain kind of attempts by Hamas to reconstitute itself, like you said, whether in northern Gaza in recent days, whether in Shifa Hospital, like we saw last month, the second battle for Shifa Hospital after the initial one in November, going after almost 1,000 Hamas and Islamic Jihad terrorists. And there is an operation still ongoing in central Gaza Strip, various kind of refugee camps there, but no Rafah yet, despite the many, many, many promises by Prime Minister Netanyahu that this was imminent operation in Rafah. Not only is the operation obviously not underway, but to the best of my understanding, the preparations for that operation haven't yet begun. And the preparations are a big part of it because a key demand by the Biden administration, but not only by the Biden administration, is that Israel allow for the evacuation of the over a million displaced people that have sought shelter in Rafah, and that any IDF operation into the city in the very, very southern most tip of Gaza has to be preceded by a major humanitarian effort to get those people out and to resituate them somewhere else in Gaza, somewhere safe, where they have
access. And you're under the impression that Israel will take that request seriously, or that demand seriously.
Yes, and I've heard that firsthand from very, very senior Israeli officials. We'll leave it at that. But yes, they understand that this is a real request, that they can't send in tanks and infantry into a densely populated area of over a million people living in tents and on the streets, that this will not fly. It's a clear red line placed on Israel by the American president himself. And so they even admit that they are at least formulating plans for the evacuation of the civilian population out of Rafah ahead of any operation. And so that will be a key sign if we see leaflets beginning to be dropped over Rafah calling on the population to evacuate, and if we see what the IDF has called these kind of humanitarian islands or humanitarian enclaves in other parts of Gaza beginning to be set up, then I will truly believe that a Rafah operation is imminent. Until then, I won't, and nor should anyone else. But it's a key question now, right? So obviously Ramadan ended, I believe, last week. So that was a key part of the calendar. Before the Iranian attack, right, the focus was on Gaza and obviously a Rafah operation, yes or no. Will a Rafah operation be delayed due to the Iranian attack and the potentially Israeli retaliation? I don't know. The IDF, and not just the IDF, are making noises like one has nothing to do with the other. I kind of beg to differ. But yeah, so you have the situation now where the actual military operation inside the Gaza Strip is on this very low boil. Obviously, the war isn't over, but it's on a very low boil, coupled with the fact that the ceasefire for hostages deal, these talks that have been going on now for several months, are at a dead end, despite the fact that several weeks ago it seemed like there had been some breakthrough and at least some reason for optimism that some deal could be agreed. Hamas responded officially last week. If anything, they've hardened their position vis-a-vis any kind of at least temporary ceasefire for 6 weeks and the release of at least 40 hostages initially. They've backtracked on what we at least understood was the initial framework for a deal as mediated by the Americans, the Egyptians, and the Qataris. So that's bad news. I mean, bad news in general, but also obviously bad news for the hostages and their loved ones who want them back, well, yesterday. And in and of itself, it may not be that surprising. Our old quote-unquote friend, Yahya Sinwar, the head of Hamas in Gaza, you know, follows the news just like we do. And what has he seen in recent weeks? In recent weeks, he's seen growing tensions between Israel and the U.S. and, by the way, the international community, especially over the humanitarian issue in the Gaza Strip and the horrible Israeli drone strike on the WCK aid convoy a few weeks ago. And so he's seen growing international pressure on Israel. So he may be thinking, hey, if I just wait a few more weeks, maybe the world will stop Israel and I don't have to make any concessions. He sees the growing debate and anger inside Israel itself from the hostage families, but not only, at the government for not doing enough to strike a deal. And now he's seen the Iranians potentially making his ultimate wish come true, which is the unification of various fronts against Israel, regional war, which will alleviate a lot of the pressure from him, obviously. And then, you know, this was already always planned, but the IDF withdrawal of the mass of its forces from Gaza, so he's under less military pressure at the moment, but that may also change, you know, if and when Rafah comes.
Okay, I love all that terrible news. I'm lucky.
It's not great. It's not great, but it's the reality of the situation. A lot of stock was put into ideally cutting a ceasefire deal, getting some of the hostages back, 6 weeks, like I said, and then using that to build on, well, you know, perhaps some kind of end to the Gaza war, the release of all the hostages. You de-escalate in the north with Lebanon. You find some modus vivendi or diplomatic arrangement for the north. That was the hope, at least. But we should be very clear. From my understanding, and the Biden administration says this openly, and even the hostage families, at least some of them, say this openly, Hamas is to blame for the fact that no deal has been reached so far. Israel has shown greater flexibility in its positions, maybe not as much flexibility as some people here would like to see, but more flexibility than Israel has shown definitely in the past in terms of what they're willing to give Hamas for at least a temporary ceasefire. So, yeah, you're dealing with a very, I don't even know what the right adjective is. I don't want to say clever, because that maybe gives them too much credit, but a very, very calculating enemy. And so the question now is, well, what happens on the Iranian front and in general in the Middle East, but also how do you find more leverage over Hamas, mm-hmm. whether militarily or diplomatically? And that's a key question.
Yeah. I think that since we last spoke, there have been 6 deals, you know, on maybe more on and off the table. So that's been hard.
Yes. We, as somebody who has to follow these things closely, you know, the permutations and the ebbs and flows of these ceasefire talks are maddening, because you know, some reports would have had you believe that a deal was imminent and that things are actually very, very optimistic. But the reality is that, you know, this is a very difficult negotiation. And we should be clear, you know, for Hamas and Sinwar himself, their biggest insurance policy are the hostages. They want to use the hostages to end the war, full stop. And they don't feel the need to relent or to soften their demands. They need to be, through one way or another, disabused of that notion.
Mm-hmm. Now, looking to the West Bank, seems like all eyes are always everywhere but there. But there are pretty frequent terror attacks from both sides. And there was an Israeli teenager killed last week, and then 2 Palestinians killed by Israeli civilians. And it might be the case that, you'll tell me if it's true, that soldiers were standing by as that happened, potentially. So is this happening more than usual? And I'm wondering, you know, what's the role or the lack of role that the IDF is playing in all of this?
So, yeah, I mean, this has been a truism since October 7th. In normal times, you know, what's been happening over the past 6 months in the West Bank would be the biggest news, not only in Israel, but the world, just in terms of the major IDF operation in the West Bank and the settler attacks that we really saw in the early stages after October 7th, settler attacks against Palestinians. Again, you know, there's only so much bandwidth for us lowly journalists to muster. And so there's only so much you can cover in a given day. But yes, the situation there isn't great either. I hate to be kind of a Debbie Downer on this episode, but this is just the reality of the situation. So like you said, Shani, there was a truly horrible murder of a 14-year-old Israeli Jewish shepherd, a settler from one of the illegal outposts in the central West Bank outside of Ramallah, this past Friday. And not surprisingly, we've seen many, many settler reprisal attacks against Palestinian villages in that part of the West Bank. Not only damage, you know, burning cars and smashing up homes and stores, but also anywhere from, say, 3 to 5 Palestinians killed. And the IDF has made it clear that this live fire did not come from them. Now, again, I don't think that should absolve the IDF from anything, because they're the ones legally, operationally, and morally responsible for security in the West Bank. And yes, like you said, we have seen videos and gotten reports that, you know, IDF soldiers or Israeli border police forces were in the vicinity of some of these attacks and didn't really step in a real way to stop them. Settler attacks, by the way, on Palestinians, and they need to do better. They have to do better. And this is on the IDF's central command responsible for the West Bank. This is on the government to take the issue a lot more seriously. But as we know, the makeup of the government, senior ministers are far right extremist settlers themselves, and protect the settlers and the settler movement politically, and also in some cases, you know, just by meddling in what the IDF is told to do and not do. And so it's a huge concern. The potential for escalation in the West Bank is real, because one of the triggers going back many years that the IDF and the Shin Bet, the intelligence service, had was that you could have this spiral of basically intercommunal violence between Israeli settlers and local Palestinians that gets out of hand from both sides. And so it's a real concern. And hopefully the Israeli authorities and the IDF get a grip on it before it goes too far. And it's, you know, it's already gone way too far.
So now you owe me an uplifting story of the week for us to end with. Do you have one, or is it, we did not get destroyed by Iran? Because that's all I've got.
I mean, the Arrow air defense system is a huge, amazing, uplifting, positive story, right? Those images of the interceptors flying through the night sky and taking down these Iranian missiles, that wasn't a given, right? This was the first real operational test for that system, which is geared, unlike the Iron Dome, to intercept, you know, longer range, heavier duty stuff. Iron Dome is more geared towards short range rockets and the like. So we didn't know if the Arrow had it in it to do this, and it showed that it does. The fact that Israel had the backing not only of the U.S., but this broad coalition arrayed across the Middle East, not a given, and this was the first time it was really put to use and operationalized in a real way. And I think maybe more fundamentally, it's amazing to me. It's almost a cliche, but it's not, because it's a real thing. But just the resilience of the Israeli public, that you're living with this reality where even prior to Saturday, like I said, yes, everyone knew or saw the reports of, you know, Iranian attack is likely imminent, but hey, until we're told otherwise, we're going to go to the beach and we're going to continue on with our daily lives. And obviously that changed very quickly Saturday evening. But then once the missiles and drones didn't get through, Sunday was a bit kind of touch and go, and, you know, this kind of nervous energy out in the streets. But, you know, people still went to work, and by Monday the restrictions were lifted. People, you know, were back on the beach. The weather is turning. Summer is coming, which is not great news for me, but, you know, again, we're talking about reality, so summer will arrive, and it will be hot on the Mediterranean. So again, this resilience is always amazing to see, especially during this very difficult time for the country, right? It wasn't a great time even before the Iranian attack. But the fact that, you know, Israelis kind of get on with things and try to lead normal lives with their families, with their work, is remarkable to see. So I think that should give us hope and lift up our spirits. And I'll probably close by saying that I hope the Israeli government, but really, like I said, the people around that war cabinet table, do the right thing and don't get Israel involved in unnecessary escalations, unnecessary adventures that you have hopefully responsible people taking responsible decisions for you know, the broader welfare of this country and the region, and that things don't get too out of hand. That's my hope.
Okay, on that note, we will wrap it up. I hope you have a relaxing end of your week, and Shabbat Shalom and Chag Sameach also.
Thank you, Shani. Shabbat Shalom, Chag Sameach, and yeah, we'll see what next week brings. Like everyone here, you know, kind of taking it day by day, but you know, last night was quiet, today is quiet. I imagine tonight will be quiet, and so that's the most we can hope for these days, at least.
Okay, Bezrat Hashem. Knock on wood now that you said that.
Thanks, Shani. Take care.